Hello, and welcome to Module 5, also known as Chapter 5. This is going to be a rather long one, so buckle down. Let's get started. So Module 5 is titled Preventing/Controlling Infection, Guard Against Possible Infection at All Times. Some of our objectives for this chapter will be to describe ways to prevent infection, practice precautions, identify procedures for medical sepsis, explain the importance of hand washing, demonstrate proper hand washing procedures, describe sterilizing and disinfecting, discuss the need for protective barriers, demonstrate proper use of gloves, describe isolation procedures, explain how to control HPV, as well as identify ways to prevent HIV/AIDS. So again, some of these topics are going to be more skill-based, and you will get a better understanding of them whenever you learn the skill, but again, this will just be kind of the backdrop. So we're starting on page 40. So turn over, we're going to go over to part one, titled Preventing Infection. So the little headliner reads, Preventing Problems is Easier Than Curing Them. So that first paragraph is going to read, infection prevention and control are critical concerns for healthcare workers. Control measures apply to everything from colds and flu to life-threatening diseases. It's going to go through to explain a little bit more what an infection is and how it's spread. Some of the highlights would be that an infection is basically spread by a microorganism, which is going to be a living organism, that can only be seen with a microscope. And these microorganisms are pretty much everywhere. So we have microorganisms in the air. Those are going to be things that are airborne, so maybe like tuberculosis. They assume that COVID at some point transmitted airborne, so that could be like COVID. Then we have in our skin, so those are like staph infections. Food and beverages, you can have E. coli in food. Those are microorganisms. And then things that are on counters and things that you touch, things that are embedded in your mucosa, which comes out in the form of mucus. So like a runny nose within the mucus in your nose, you can have a microorganism in there, like influenza. That's why that is passed through droplet. So basically, microorganisms are these tiny little agents that are somewhat foreign to your body and can be harmful to your body that usually we just can't see, right? That's the synopsis of it all. And then it says there are two types of microorganisms, pathogenic and non-pathogenic, right? So microorganisms that cause diseases are bacteria, viruses, and fungus. So these are going to be the main three things we're focused on when we talk about microorganisms. Like I said, some are harmful and some are harmless. So I'm sure you guys are familiar with, like, when we talk about gut bacteria, right? So you do have bacteria in your gut. However, that's quote-unquote good bacteria, which means it's not harmless to the body. If anything, it's serving our purpose is helping to kind of clean things up and maintain homeostasis in your gut lining. So those are good bacteria or non-pathogenic, harmless bacteria. Then you have pathogenic bacteria, right? So let's say you get a stomach infection or the stomach bug. Maybe you get norovirus or parainfluenza, like something, or rotavirus for babies. Or some kind of E. coli, which is a bacteria, enters in your system. Again, now that your body's recognizing this is a bacteria or a virus or a fungi, but it is not one that we want to stay in the body. It considers it harmful and pathogenic, right? So that's going to be your main difference between the two. Now, what's really, really important is going to be the spread. How is infection spread and how do we contribute to stopping that spread? So it says pathogens are usually enter the body through broken or damaged skin or through the mucous membranes of the eyes, nose, or mouth. And this is going to contribute to the chain of infection, which has six links that we're going to go over. So funny enough, your skin is actually your biggest and most forthright immune process, right? It's the biggest barrier to anything entering into your organs and your systems. So your skin is that first line of defense from protecting yourself from any illnesses. So that's why it's really important when you have a cut or a bruise or a wound, some kind of opening in the skin, that you're very protective of it, you're covering it up, and you're very protective of what you're touching, because technically when you have a cut, you've just compromised your biggest form of protection, right? Which is your skin. So now let's talk about the six links in the chain of infection. I'm going to describe each, and then we're basically going to talk about how we break that link. So we have infectious agents, right? So we talked about it. We know what pathogens are, and they are going to be organisms that produce disease. Then we have the reservoir. This is where we kind of come in place. It says where organisms grow and reproduce, often moist and warm, right? So you'll start to kind of hear in healthcare that we don't really like moist, warm, dark environments, because those are really, really, really good or very common places that things like bacteria like to grow, so, or mold or something like that. So just think about if you have like damp laundry, right? Let's say you put some things in the laundry and you didn't move it to the dryer and it just sits there, right? So inside that washing machine, it's dark. It's going to start getting warm in there, and it's damp, right? So that you'll see, if you were to leave clothes kind of damp in that washer for like a week or two, when you take it out, it starts to have a smell. You start to have some kind of pathogen growing on it, right? Because again, that's just the environment that bacteria and fungi like to grow in. So we talk about that as those are good reservoirs, right? Portal of exit, how germs get out of the body, or the how germs get out of the reservoir, right? So let me take a step back. We are reservoirs as well, right? Within our system, we, inside of our body, we are warm, we are dark, and there's a lot of liquid and fluids moving around. So we can be reservoirs as well. I'll get into more detail a little bit later. Portal of exit is how that organism is going to leave the reservoir. So if you're talking in regards to the body, very, very easy, clean and cut, something leaving the body is going to be urine or feces or mucus coming out of your nose or your mouth when you cough, right? So that is a portal of exit. So I'll take you through a chain in just a little bit. Then transmission is how germs spread from source to person, right? So just because something's leaving out of your body doesn't mean it's automatically targeted towards someone else. There has to be some kind of contact made between one person or the other for whatever pathogen it is to be spread. And we'll talk about different forms of transmission. Portal of entry, now we've gone to the other person or the new host. It's how it's going to get inside of them, right? Which would be probably very similar to how it left you or it left the reservoir. Then we're going to go to susceptible host, person lacking resistance to particular infection. So let's follow kind of a little chain with the chain of infection. So we're going to start with, let's start with the flu. So the flu is a pathogen. Influenza is the more medically appropriate term. Influenza is a virus, right, that can produce disease. It's something that enters into the body and kind of causes a systemic response, which means you feel symptoms in different parts of your body, right, or all over your body, whether that's chills, a headache, a runny nose, not feeling too well, things like that. So your body's going to have this immune response to influenza in your body. That's why we say it's a disease producing, you know, it's a harmful thing, because your body has to fight against it, because it's not something that should stay in there for long. Because at some point it can work its way into your lungs, compromise your lung function, which becomes a problem. So we consider it a harmful pathogen, right? Now, we're going to call, let's just say someone is the reservoir. So let's say you have the flu, okay? And the flu is growing inside of your body, which is a reservoir. And now the portal of exit would be through your mucus. When you sneeze, when you blow your nose, just any kind of mucus coming out of your body, which is usually going to come through the nose and the mouth. So now, up until this point, you haven't necessarily passed it on to anyone. This is where it starts to get passed on. When transmission occurs, this can be through sneezing. This can be through rubbing your nose and then touching the desk, rubbing your nose and then giving someone a hug. Now you are actually transmitting it from yourself to someone else or putting it out there for it to be contracted. Now, portal of entry. Let's say someone comes up to you. You just blew your nose, right? You didn't wash your hands. You still got some of the germs on you. Person comes up, says, hey, how's it been? They give you a hug, shake your hand, right? Now, it has been transmitted. Now, the portal of entry for them would be their hands. Or it's going to be their mouth. But their hands, right? Let's say the other person gets the, you know, shakes your hand, and they don't go and wash their hands. So now they are bringing their hands up to their nose, or they're rubbing their eyes, or they sneeze, and this is before any hand washing has been done. They have now introduced that virus to some form of entry, which would be possibly the nose or the mouth, and now it can now enter into their system and start to do all the things that it's been doing to you. Now, susceptible hosts is going to be people that do not have a robust immune response, right? Or someone who's lacking resistance to a particular infection. So we can build resistance to different infections just based on our exposure, but mainly there are certain people, right? So if you think of people who have cancer, they are immunocompromised. Older patients tend to be immunocompromised. Children, they're not immunocompromised. However, they're, especially little babies, their immune system is brand new and it's just building, so they are also susceptible. So that basically means for the average person with a healthy immune system, you should be able to fight most pathogens that come in your body. You may not feel well for a few days, but your immune system is equipped to fight, which is why you get all of these symptoms, you know, the fever, that is your body heating up to kind of trap or overheat the pathogen, the lethargy, your body's trying to get you to rest so that it can get to work. All these things the average person can and will do to fight that infection, and hopefully after a few days, worse after a couple of weeks, you are well. If you are dealing with a susceptible host, which is a person who is immunocompromised or does not have a robust immune system, their body is a bit sluggish in basically getting rid of pathogens, which is dangerous, right? Because either whenever a pathogen stays in the body for too long, it can overwhelm the system. So that's when you start to get things like sepsis, which is when the body has been trying to fight for so long and it's kind of getting tired. And the infection, funny thing about pathogens is they can move from system to system. So staph is a very good explanation of this, right? And staph is usually something that sits on the skin. So staph that can start on the skin, if it sits there, can work its way from skin to fat tissue to bone to the bloodstream. And once that same infection that was on the skin moves to the bloodstream is moving all throughout the body. Now you're going to get what we call a systemic illness, where it's now going to be flowing through the bloodstream and affecting different organs. And this is where people get really, really sick and even die, right? So this is why we have to be super serious about stopping the spread of infection, especially when we're dealing with people in healthcare settings who are most likely somewhat immunocompromised. Even if you're a healthy person, just the time frame, if you are hospitalized or you are sick in that moment, you are a bit immunocompromised just because you're exposed to so many different pathogens, you're not moving around as much, or your body is using a whole lot of cortisol to try to help you fight the infection. So there's a plethora of different things. There's a reason people go to the hospital and get a little bit sicker. So to move on, basically we're worried about breaking any link of the chain, right? So we went through those six links. If you can stop it at any point, you have broken the link. So in regards to like portal of exit, how the germs are getting out of the body, this is why we wear masks, right? So that whenever you sneeze, we've kind of stifled or stopped that portal of entry from causing damage, because even though the mucus is going to come out of your mouth, it's not going to just go into the air and transmit that way. But really where we focus on is transmission, which is how germs are spread from source to person. And this is where hand washing becomes the most effective way of breaking the chain of infection, because it's inevitable that you're going to touch your eyes, touch your nose, sneeze, that you're going to touch a counter, that you're going to touch other people. That's very hard to not do. But if you are constantly washing your hands, especially in these healthcare settings when we know that we are exposing ourselves to a bunch of different organisms and we know that we're interacting with people who are immunocompromised, making sure that you are washing your hands before and after procedures or contact with anyone or just on a scheduled basis is going to constantly remove those pathogens from your portals of exit or your hands, or basically keep you from consistently and constantly spreading germs because you're constantly washing them off. So hand washing is going to be a huge, huge thing in healthcare. We kind of talked about some of the signs and symptoms of infections, and it just explains why it's very, very important for you not to come to work when you're sick, especially in the healthcare setting, because if your body is giving you symptoms, especially a fever, then it means that you have a high amount of that pathogen in your body, which means you're highly contagious, and we do not want to spread infection to people that we know have a hard time fighting it, and what is just a simple flu for you can turn into pneumonia for someone else, right? So going over to page 41, this is practicing medical asepsis, right? So this is basically what we just talked about, washing our hands. Very, very, very important. This goes across the board. This is taught to anyone who works in the healthcare setting. Doctors are hounded about this. It is the number one way to stop the stop transmission of infections, right? So basically it says wash your hands. These are some key times to wash your hands. You want to keep this in mind. These are some key times to wash your hands before and after your work shift, before and after breaks and meals, before and after each resident contact, after using the toilet. We know that E. coli can live in feces, which is fine in feces, but we don't want it in our hands and then passing it on and putting it in our mouth when we eat or vice, you know, etc. After handling bedpans, feces, specimens, used bandages and dressings, after coughing, sneezing, blowing your nose, after handling soiled linen or a resident's personal belongings, before and after wearing disposable gloves. So again, this is going to be a hot spot for you. And again, hand washing is going to be one of the skills for state testing. So you really, really, really want to remember, when is it important for me to be washing my hands? Very, very big and key one is going to be before and after wearing gloves, right? Because most of your skills, you're going to have to put on, don, and doff gloves. You're going to have to put gloves on and off, and you need to remember that you are washing your hands before and after doing that. And then also, very, very important with the state skills, whenever you're handling bedpans or patient belongings or just anything that is in that patient's room, especially that is interacting with parts of them that can spread infection, that's when you want to make sure that you're washing your hands, okay? So just pay attention to that section, read over it, make sure that you're really understanding the best and prime times to wash your hands. And here, I'll just kind of read this through, but this is something you will see visually, and it will make a whole lot more sense to you. But these are basically the steps of proper hand washing techniques, okay? Number one, you want to assemble all equipment before you begin. So the soap, paper towels, and the trash can, waste basket. Number two, run water until it's warm and completely wet your hands and wrists. We like warm water when we wash our hands. Apply soaps and lather vigorously. Hands, wrists, fingers. Hands, wrists, and fingers for at least 20 seconds. I think they'll teach you this, but I think the Happy Birthday song is a good song to sing that will get you through those 20 seconds. Clean your fingernails by rubbing soapy fingertips against the palm of the opposite hand. You want to keep your nails short just because pathogens can live inside of your nail beds. So the longer they are, the higher of a chance that you may have some pathogens sitting in there. Five, rinse well with warm water, warm running water, hands lower than your elbows and fingertips down. Pat dry thoroughly with a clean paper towel and dispose of the towel. Use a clean, dry paper towel to turn off the water and dispose of the towel. And again, it's just highlighting that germs are found in moist and warm areas. That's why we want to make sure whenever you wash your hands, you avoid touching the sink or faucet at any time. You can turn it into a little game. How do you wash your hands and not touch the sink? Because it holds a lot of germs. That's where people are washing germs into, right? And then we always want to make sure that we are thoroughly drying our hands, because again, we don't want to walk around with damp hands, because what do we know about damp environments? So let's go over to page 42. And these are just kind of other ways that we can stop the spread of infection. But again, hand washing will be number one. So just clean surroundings, which involve sterilization and disinfection. So basically cleaning your environment, right? So if we know that organisms can live on countertops and spoons and things that we've touched, if you are cleaning your environment constantly, especially in the workplace where you come in and someone who may not have washed their hands was sitting at the computer that you're about to sit at, or is using the mouse that you're about to use, that mouse is going to be very capable of spreading a lot of infection, especially when you're dealing with things that are contact, that spread through contact. So just making it a habit when you get to work, cleaning your immediate environment, and then making sure we have a clean environment for our patients as well. With disinfectants and different sterilization. Every facility kind of has the type of disinfectants and sterilizations that they like to use, and as well as making sure that we're keeping linens clean. So if you are coming in and you're seeing your patient is sitting in soiled linens, not only is that bad for their skin integrity, but also there can be, you know, you can have a urinary tract infection, right? That's sometimes that comes from some kind of pathogen in the urine. And if that urine is just sitting in the bed, that's a pathogen that's just sitting in the bed. So just making sure that we're keeping a clean environment. Going over to part three, we're going to go over to page 43. This is where we talk about personal protective equipment. So on top of hand washing, on top of disinfecting, on top of sterilization, we can also create barriers between ourselves to limit, slow down, or completely stop the spread of infection, right? So a very, very, very easy one that we can all remember is masks, right? So when the pandemic hit and COVID was rampant and we believed that COVID was spread through droplets, right? We were doing our best to restrain those droplets from going everywhere, right? Or if we believe something is passed airborne, then we introduce an N95, right? So that little pathogens that are in the particles of the air that we breathe are not being passed around. So we're creating a barrier between ourselves and the, you know, other people. So a mask is a very, very, very easy one to remember in regards to PPE, because it's going to stop that germ from getting to the next person. But we also have a bunch of other PPE. So one that you'll become very familiar with is gloves, right? So we know that we can spread a lot by the things that we touch. So whenever we put a glove over our hand, we are creating an extra barrier for us and for other people, right? So if I go into a patient's room and I perform pericare or something in, you know, that involves me interacting with some kind of bodily fluid, and I use gloves the entire time and I dispose of it before I leave the room, technically my hands never made contact with that bodily fluid or pathogen. So it makes it harder for me to be able to spread it. Now we go above and beyond to make sure we wash our hands before and after. And if these are done properly and continuously, it really should limit any spread of infection if we're constantly creating more and more barriers. So we are moving on to, we have face masks, we have gloves, and we have gowns, right? So gowns are going to basically protect the whole body. And you'll learn which PPE is necessary for different procedures. If you remember kind of in the pandemic, you would see people going into rooms and they had full gowns and masks and eye shields and gloves. You know, they were PPE down just to put extra protection between themselves and the patients. But in the surgery, you'll see surgery that they are pretty much covered up head to toe, because surgery is a very, very vulnerable time for patients where they're just completely exposed to a bunch of different pathogens. So you want to make sure you're not introducing any infections. So different environments, different scenarios, different ADLs, different skills will require different levels of protective personal equipment, but it's good to know what some of the main ones are and why we use them. So going over to isolation. So isolation is basically when residents with highly transmissible diseases are sometimes be set apart to protect others. So good examples of this would be COVID and TB, tuberculosis, right? So even though, like we said, we know all pathogens are capable of spreading, there are some that are just very, very, very contagious, basically. They love to jump from person to person to person to person, or they're very hard to contain, right? So tuberculosis is airborne, just very, very difficult, which means it travels by the air. That means you don't even have to make any physical contact with someone. Just being in the same vicinity where you are breathing the air that they breathe, you can contract tuberculosis, which causes people to have to be in isolation just because we know that it is very hard to contain. So if you ever see this at the hospital, they'll be in something we call a negative pressure room, which is basically try to keep all of their air within that room and they're not joining the general circulation, right? So that's gonna be a time where isolation is necessary, as well as, like I said, things like COVID, whenever you'd have patients in the hospital or even in nursing homes or assisted livings with known COVID, they would isolate them, right? So again, if you think about it, these are all just ways of trying to put a distance between the pathogen and the next person. So if you can wash your hands, you can have them wear a mask so that it's not spreading. Then you can put them away from the general population. You are creating multiple barriers for the pathogen so that it is not so easily spread. And that is what we want to do, right? So usually the specific isolation precautions that a patient has will be doctor ordered and communicated to you as well by the nurse. And usually, depending on the setting, but sometimes they'll put a sign that patient's room just so that you know. And again, there's different types of isolation. There's contact isolation, droplet isolation, things like that. So if you have someone with a pathogen in their stool causing them to have maybe like diarrhea or something like C. diff, they're probably going to be on a heavy kind of extended contact precaution, letting you know that anytime that you're in there, be very, very cautious of what you're touching. And you pretty much have to wear gloves. Sometimes it requires a gown just to create an extra barrier between you and whatever that pathogen is, right? And it just says other precautions. Use extreme caution with needles and infectious waste. Be aware of how infection is spread and use personal protective equipment to protect yourself and others from infection. So this is going to take us to some of the hepatitis and AIDS, HIV, and how they spread. But one thing that's going to be huge in healthcare system is making sure we do not have any needle punctures to the skin as healthcare professionals, right? So in the CNA role, you should not interact with needles too often. That should be more so the nurse. But you could be in the presence of needles, be in the presence of things that can compromise the skin. So if you remember earlier in the chapter, we talked about your skin is your biggest immune defense. So that means if something penetrates through your skin and either goes directly into your bloodstream or, you know, breaks the barrier of your skin, that is a big deal. So there's so many precautions in place of how to safely handle needles, how to cap needles, how to dispose of needles to make sure that we are not spreading things. And then also when we're talking about certain infections that are passed through blood, from blood to blood, we do, like HIV AIDS, we do not want to get access to someone's blood and then directly transmit it into another one, right? So that's why needle sticks are going to be very, 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 very high risk for transmitting these heavier, scarier infections, okay? So moving on, we're going to part four, and we're on page 44 now. It just says hepatitis B virus is a viral infection of the liver. The disease causes fatigue, mouth, fever, muscle, and joint pain, nausea, vomiting, and loss of appetite. It's particularly dangerous because we do not have a cure for hepatitis B. And it just slowly eats away at the liver, right? Which is a problem. The liver is a very, very, very important organ in the body. And we don't want something where we have this virus that we have no cure to that is basically just going to eat the liver up until it's completely finished and damaged. So we are very, very, very careful with the spread of that. And we just, in healthcare, we try to just assume that everyone has something, right? So imagine you come into a room, and this happens a lot in the hospital. Let's say a patient comes in, and we need to do flu and COVID tests. We know they're sick, but we don't know what it is yet. And we need to do a couple of, you know, some tests to see what they have. And while we're getting the test, we don't have a mask on, or we don't have gloves on, or they were in the lobby getting registered, or they were standing in the lobby getting vital signs. And then they get in the room, we swab them, we send it to the lab, it comes back positive, right? Now everyone wants to gown up, and now everyone's putting on a mask. But you've been exposed to this patient since they walked into the hospital. Before you knew they had something confirmed, you've been exposed to whatever that they have. So this is really how people get sick, because you just can't usually tell exactly what someone has just by looking at them. And so many people are walking around in the streets and in these facilities with something that they may not know they have, right? So that's why we just kind of walk around assuming that everyone is guilty until proven innocent, right? That everyone is carrying something. That's why we don't want to protect ourselves after the fact. We want to be preventative. But it says HPV usually spreads through contact with infected blood, blood products, body fluids, or anywhere blood is present, right? So this is why we're very, very careful with blood. So following our examples of how the virus spreads, sexual contact is going to be the biggest and, you know, broadest way to spread blood to blood, or spread viruses or pathogens that are bloodborne. Damaged skin, of course, puncture wounds from contaminated needles or sharp objects, mucous membranes. So where this is really going to pertain to you is damaged skin, cuts and rashes, or puncture wounds from contaminated needles, right? So anytime a needle has made contact with a human, it is officially contaminated. You don't even need to know with what. It's contaminated, and we want to handle that ever so carefully. So in the case that maybe you see a needle hanging around or it was improperly disposed, you want to bring attention to that immediately and dispose it in the sharps, just because we do not want any contaminated needles entering into anyone's system. In the case that that happens, you will usually immediately have to go to occupational health, where they're going to run a panel of tests on you, because, again, it is a big deal. So we're going to move over to page 45. And page 44 was just talking about some vaccinations. So a vaccination is basically something that was curated to help slow down or stop a disease process, right? Usually disease processes that were becoming overwhelming or was just highly contagious. So for example, we have COVID vaccination, right? That's not something we've had forever. It's something that was developed over the past few years because it was so highly contagious, right? So we know that these vaccinations will not usually do not completely protect you for being able to contract the virus. However, in the case that you do contract the virus, it tends to lessen the symptoms and hopefully help from or keep that pathogen from overwhelming your system. And basically, vaccination, it gets complicated, but basically the body is introduced to an organism that would usually be harmful, but it is introduced to the harmless version of it so that your body can develop an immune response. And on top of the immediate immune response that you produce, so that's the fever, you know, the chills, the headache, you also create a long-term immune response. This is done with B cells, but basically your body makes memory of what it just fought, right? So If it just fought COVID, your immune system is going to fight it, you know, in the short term, but also it's going to take a few months. But your body is going to kind of create the system so that if it were to see that infection again, it can fight quicker. So that it's kind of sharpening its response so that it cannot be afflicted with that infection or that pathogen with the same fierceness every time. So what we are doing with vaccinations is introducing the body to these pathogens. However, they're not harmful. They remove the harmful bits of it, most of it, introducing it to the body so that when and if the body were to actually see the actual harmful version of that pathogen again, it would hit it immediately because the body has already kind of created this, you know, army that's ready to fight it. So that really is the concept of vaccination. That's why you're always going to see when you enter into a healthcare facility, the option to get a hepatitis B vaccination or to boost your titers or something like that, because they know that that is something that is very prevalent in the healthcare setting, and they just want to be preventative and just give, you know, your body a fighting chance in the case that you were exposed to that. But that's going to take us to part five on page 45, where it talks about HIV/AIDS, right? So, you know, HIV, which is related to AIDS, HIV and AIDS are pretty much the same, right? So HIV is human immunodeficiency virus, and AIDS is acquired immune deficiency syndrome. So basically, HIV is the virus, whereas AIDS is when the virus has overwhelmed the body, right? So someone can have HIV and not have AIDS, whereas if someone has AIDS, most likely they started with HIV. So AIDS is a life-threatening condition caused by a virus known by HIV. The virus cripples the immune system, the body's natural defense against disease, by destroying cells. HIV interferes with the ability to fight out viruses, bacteria, and fungi. The term AIDS refers to the later stages of HIV infection. So what's particularly interesting and really dangerous about HIV and AIDS is because when people are experiencing mortality or fatality or dying from HIV or AIDS, it's not necessarily from the virus itself. Like, the virus is not infecting the body. Usually the virus is so dangerous because its goal is to go through and pretty much kill the immune system, right? So that whenever the person is exposed to all of these viruses and pathogens and, you know, bacteria and fungi that probably the average person is, you know, coming in contact with on a continuous basis, their body's not able to fight it the same, right? So flu, let's do flu and influenza. Let's say, like, particularly me, I work with children. Right, I probably am exposed to flu on a daily basis, right? Number one, I get the flu vaccine. Number two, I've gotten the flu a few times, so I also have an immune response. So I'm not constantly getting sick by flu, right? But with me, when my body is seeing it, it may give me like runny nose or a headache or chills for like a night. Like, it gives me a quick response because, again, my response is quickened because I have an immune response to it. But it's not going to take me out, right? Because I have a good immune system, which means my body is going to do its job. It's going to get rid of the pathogen and let me go about my life, right? Where people with HIV/AIDS tend to be afflicted, and this is also something that afflicts, you know, people with cancer as well, is when they come in contact with something like the flu that you probably walk by every day, or they come in contact with something like MRSA or staph that's sitting on the counters of hospital that, again, you probably touch and interact with every day and usually get away with. When they come in contact with that, their immune system is so weak and has been so degraded by this human immunodeficiency virus that they cannot fight it with the same fierceness. So something that just gave you symptoms for a few days can pretty much lead someone else into full-blown sepsis, full-blown systemic infection, and ultimately kill them, right? So that's why this is a particularly, like, terrible pathogen, because it doesn't even just strike directly. It just creates an environment where anything can take you out, right? Like, anything. And it just slowly eats at the immune system and eats at the body until people are just so weak and they can't fight anything. So this is, and we do not have a cure for it, right? There are things to decrease the symptoms and there are preventatives, But there is no official cure for HIV/AIDS, right? So this is going to be some of the main ways that it is spread, and then we'll talk about ways that we're going to kind of break that chain of transmission. So intimate sexual contact, that is a number of ways HIV and AIDS is spread. Transfusions with infected blood, so, people getting, blood transfusions, that's why they test the blood to make sure there's nothing in it before they are transfusing it to anyone else. Puncture wounds from infected needles, or broken glass, cuts or open sores. Mucous membranes, nose, mouth, eyes, use of infected hypodermic needles, infected mothers to their unborn babies, right? So really the main form of transmission that pertains to you in a healthcare setting is puncture wounds from infected needles, cuts or open sores, or mucous membranes, or use of infected needles, right? Those are going to be the things that you're exposed to. And again, just walking up to someone, you would not know that there was hepatitis B flowing in their veins or the HIV virus is living in them, right? If they're not very symptomatic, they may not present that they are sick or that they're infected with something. This is why we treat everyone in healthcare like they have something until proving otherwise. That's why we are super, super precautious. That's why we're washing our hands as much as possible. That's why we're wearing gloves. That's why we have proper disposal techniques for sharps, needles, etc. That's why we are constantly covering up sores, and making sure that we're not exposing our skin to things. This is why we're wearing masks and not coming to work if we're sick, and washing our hands so that we're not putting things in mucous membranes like nose and our mouth and our eyes. This is why we're going above and beyond, because we do not know what the next person has. And if we're just walking by this person on the street, not a big deal. But we are in a field where we are interacting with people, right? We're interacting with their bodily fluids. We're interacting with them when they're ill. We're interacting with, sometimes blood. We're interacting with so much more than we would in the outside world. So we have to be highly, 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 highly cautious, and we have to be preventative, right? We don't want a oopsie or sorry situation because that could be life-threatening, right? Oh, my bad, I forgot to cap the needle and I punctured myself, could lead you to an incurable disease, right? Whereas if we're preventative, we can make sure that we are not in situations where we are being vulnerable and exposing ourselves to all of these pathogens. So I'm just going to read the summary over to you. Actually, let's talk about the main ways to protect. It says always use precautions to protect yourself and others from infection. Treat all blood and bodily fluids as contaminated. I cannot stress that enough. Anytime you're dealing with bodily fluids and blood, just assume they have the worst infection in the world. Just assume it. It is in your best interest to just assume it. You do not need a confirmed test, right? There's no reason ever on this planet for you to be touching bodily fluids with your bare hands. That is unacceptable. You should always have gloves. Always wash your hands before and after. If it calls for it, have a gown. But you should treat all bodily fluids and blood as if they have known infections, right? Wear gloves whenever you have contact with body fluids and swelled articles. Wash your hands with soap and water after any contact with blood, even if gloves were worn. Use the same precautions with vaginal secretions and semen. Pour all liquid waste containing blood down the toilet. Avoid splashing on yourself. Put the toilet lid down and flush. Also, flush tissues and other flushable items with blood or body fluids on them. Use a disposable bag for paper towels and wound dressings, sanitary pads, and other solid waste. Close the bag securely. Follow disposal regulations for the facility where you work. So, as you can see, even how you dispose of these fluids will be important, because they can contaminate surrounding areas even in the process of their disposal. Summary: protect yourself, residents, coworkers, and visitors from infection by using precautions. The best defense is understanding how infection spreads and using preventative measures. Thorough hand washing is the single most important preventative measure for infection and control. Cannot stress that enough. Other important measures include clean surroundings, personal protective equipment, and isolation precautions. Always protect residents from infection, provide quality care, and treat all bodily fluids and needles as potentially infectious. So if you didn't hear anything else I said, I hope that last paragraph really reared in the points. Again, please go through, complete the review on page 46 to kind of test your knowledge. And on that note, that concludes module 5. We'll see you on the next module.